The Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series, produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity, past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, The Story of Home, with your host, Donnie Antle.
Welcome to The Story of Home. I'm Donnie Antle. In this episode, the British are coming. Tracing the history of the first English settlers on Cape Breton Island is tricky, as historical records from the period leave large gaps in the story. Sarah McGinnis is the historian at the Fortress of Louisbourg National Park.
It's interesting, too, because we have so much information about the French, but the French were such immaculate record keepers. So every administrative record that was created in Louisbourg, there were three copies, one for here, one for Quebec, and one for France. So that helps us immensely, especially when the reconstruction came about, to have access to that information was incredible. The British do not have that here at all. It's a very different experience.
As Sarah explains, the lack of records leaves those who study history unable to form a complete picture of historical events and the far-reaching implications of those events.
in 1745, you have the New England siege. And the New Englanders stay here during that time. But information from then is incredibly spotty in comparison, which is too bad because that New England occupation plays an important role in the Revolution later, because New Englanders really feel slighted. They come up here, they fight, they're left here to winter and face huge losses. Half of the 2,000-person garrison passes away in that first winter. I mean, that's really incredible and terribly devastating. And then all of a sudden, 1748 comes and Britain signs a treaty and gives it back to the French. And New Englanders really are hurt by this because A, they don't feel they have a say, and B, it's the first time they've ever fought together for something. And now it's being taken from them by a group of people that are across the ocean from them and aren't really sharing in that experience that they had.
David and Pam Newton came to Cape Breton over 50 years ago and became fascinated with the story of the first English people to come here. Between them, they've written 6 books on Cape Breton's early English settlers.
The Americans in 1945 marched up from various militia groups from New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, in the United States. They banded together. They were fed up with what the French were doing in Louisburg, attacking their fishing ships and things like that. So they marched up here, walked all the way, built rafts to cross the Strait of Canso, kept on going, fought the French and beat them. And the French army, in those days, the French army was thought to be the best in the world, and they beat them. And then they walked home, all the way back again. And my personal theory is that they and later their sons and even grandsons were so teed off by what the British had done that not only they were resentful of Britain giving back this place they'd won it for the British at quite a lot of cost and casualties, but also it showed that they, the local militias, could beat the French, the greatest army in the world. So that probably was one of the spurs that incited them to join in the revolution and fight the British there.
The first English settlers to live here were the soldiers tasked with the demolition of the fortress of Louisbourg.
Louisbourg falls in 1758, and they begin deporting the French. But then, of course, once the French are gone, there's a need to keep a British presence here so that the French can't retake it. So the British maintain a presence. The next year, Quebec falls. Things kind of start falling into place. And over the decisions then made that Louisbourg is to be destroyed. The British have already given it back to the French. They don't want that situation to ever arise again. So they decide they're going to systematically destroy the fortifications. So you end up with this British presence living in Louisbourg up until 1768, predominantly, just destroying the fortifications in the town. After 1768, once Louisbourg is destroyed, you see some of those people stay in the area, but settlement really moves towards where the modern town of Louisbourg is today, not really on the fortress site at that time.
Joyce Rankin is the director of the Old Sydney Society.
There's always this sort of discrepancy between the sponsored settlements, of which there were records kept, and then some of the people who just kind of came, right? And so it's hard to track that. But there were people living in the vicinity of Louisbourg who lived by trading, you know, with the people in the fortress. So when the French left, those people wouldn't really have had any way of leaving. I mean, so their sort of economic base was gone, but they were still here. Like, if you were, you know, fishing or whatever, or trading, farming and trading with the people in the fortress, how are you going to leave?
Yeah.
You know? So those people would have just stayed in place. But a lot of them, they're not really accounted for in history.
For the next 16 years, the Crown didn't do much to encourage settlers to come to Cape Breton. In fact, they actively discouraged settlement on the island until 1784. However, Cape Breton was a key strategic holding on the eastern seaboard, as Joyce explains.
Think about Sydney in the Atlantic Ocean and the ships going up the St. Lawrence. So strategically, it's pretty important. They had Newfoundland, but at that point, you weren't allowed to settle in Newfoundland, right? So they wanted a settlement that could serve as a military base and a naval sort of watching base as well. So they had other places that they were putting their resources. So this wasn't seen as a profitable place to encourage settlement. It was really just the strategic aspect of it.
Then, a shot heard round the world rings out from a field just outside of Boston, and the 13 colonies rise up in revolution. The conflict creates a group of refugees who flee north to the safety of British-held Canada. These refugees are the Loyalists.
The first sort of official group were the Loyalists who came here, so 1785, because Cape Breton had been a French possession, being separate from the rest of Nova Scotia. So as a colony, it was a French possession. When it became an English possession after the Second Treaty of Paris, then for the English, it became a matter of some concern that most of the people living here were not English. So that's when they started trying to promote settlement by English, right? So the American War of Independence, American Revolution, was an opportunity for them to... So during the war, the people who remained loyal to the British were promised compensation for property that they would lose. And after the war, when the United States gained their independence, then the British had to make reparations. So for them, it was kind of like a two-for-one, right? So they get to keep their word to the loyalists, and they get English people looking to settle. So, of course, some of them got to, you know, Ontario and different places, some to New Brunswick. This was not, like, the first choice of a lot of people. Some of the people who came here were, you know, used to living in the city. They were not farmers and fishermen. They were people who were politicians and professional people and merchants. So it was not, not an easy transition for them.
Jocelyn Bethune is a writer and documentarian from Bedeque. She's been tracing the story of one particular loyalist settler and admits that forming a complete picture can be difficult.
The story of Jonathan Jones, of other loyalists, like their entire stories have not been written. We don't know. I know he refers to DeBar, and I know he refers to some of the other government things that are happening, but I didn't know what those things were. And they're kind of question marks that you hang up on a hook. It's like, I'm going to go back to that someday. So yes, there's more about Jonathan Jones and the Loyalists here than we know right now.
Jocelyn's been piecing together the story of one Captain Jonathan Jones, who settled on the banks of the Bedeque River. She has a family connection to the good captain.
So I really wondered why he would leave all of that as a businessman and come to Cape Breton. And then in part of our research, my husband is a descendant of Jonathan Jones. So there's naturally a tie to want to find out just about his family and about our family, because our children are, of course, descendants of Jonathan Jones. And our son, our youngest son, is Jonathan. So my husband was interested in this, and we found letters along the way, which are incredible. Written March 26th, 1797, And he's writing from Bedeck, "Dear Brother," the brother that's in Ontario. And it's written, of course, in script, and it's 6 pages long. And he writes about his life here. And when I was researching, I loved it when I found typewritten things, because reading somebody else's script was frustrating. But for some reason, my husband was able to read it. And I'll never forget the night when we finally started reading this. And it was dark, and there was just this little lamp we had over my desk. And I was typing it to transcribe it as he was reading it. And it just felt like we had come back in time. And then at the end of it, Jonathan Jones says, "I have to end because my candle has burned low." And he couldn't see anymore, so he had to end the letter. But in that letter, he provided the answer to me as to why he moved here. Why did he move to rural Bedeck on the far-flung edges of this continent? And this is what he said. This is what he wrote to his brother. "You see how we live here, separated from all the world, a little republic of our own. I sometimes think we are as happy as though we were in the hurry and bustle of company. The children are all well, and I'm happy to have it in my power to tell you that they constitute the principal part of the pleasure that I enjoy or ever expect to enjoy in this life." So, like, that's why he's here. It's because it doesn't matter about the businesses, it doesn't matter about it. He wants to make sure his kids grow up healthy. And I thought, anybody understands that. Like, it just put so many things into perspective for me. And I felt like we connected over those centuries. It was very powerful. And that's what I love about history, is that you can go to places and you can read about their motivations, and then you think, wow, what an incredible life. It must have been so different. It must have been so different from what we have, but it's not, because at the end of the day, the choices you make are, you want your family to be healthy.
The story of Jonathan Jones is typical of those early loyalists forced from their homes in the 13 colonies, as Jocelyn explains.
From the research that I can find is that he was born in Connecticut.
Okay.
He was born in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I'm not sure when he moved to New York, but he was married in New York in 1768. So he was living there by the time he was an adult. In lots of different references I've seen, they've referred to him as being from Wales. But I think his family came from Wales. And lots of times there's more than one Jonathan. And he's got a brother, John. And I've never been able to find out what his father's name is. So that really limits how far back I can go. But we know for sure he lived... his last known address, if you will, in the United States was Fort Edward. I've seen it referred to different things. Fort Edward, Glens Falls is another place. But that was where he lived. He was branded an obnoxious Tory. He was a loyalist, which in Canada are the good guys, in the U.S. are the bad guys. He was loyal to the British cause. He had a business. He had a grist mill, and was a justice of the peace in Glens Falls, which is, I think, 60 kilometers from Albany. And he was very successful. He had 4 children. He was married to Sarah Sampson. And as I said, they married in May of 1768 in New York City. And he was branded an obnoxious Tory because he continued to believe that the British had the right way to govern. So Jonathan Jones lost his house. His house was burned to the ground. He lost, his land was sold. What I feel is that in that fire, in that burnt out building of a deliberately set fire, he lost his home, his treasured possessions, and really what he lost was his sense of belonging.
According to Jocelyn, Captain Jones appears to be a bit of a man of mystery.
There's a lot of mystery that surrounds Jonathan Jones, and in a lot of the research I've come up with, it's like he's on the periphery of all of these associations. There's like they're called the Green Mountain Boys, and they were couriers that brought messages from the British in New York to Canada, to Quebec. So, and they did sort of things, they did things like that. And Jonathan Jones had a company. He was the captain of a company of militiamen who fought in the Revolutionary War. Jonathan Jones was injured. He was shot on the battlefield, one of the pivotal battles at Freeman's Farm, and which is at either at that point or a little bit later on where Burgoyne actually surrenders. So he's sort of, it's almost like he's Forrest Gump. He's like, he witnesses all of these incredible moments, and then I read other things, and it's like, is he a spy? Is, you know, like there's espionage, there's hints of these things. And then one of the company of men, I researched some of the men that were in his company, and one of the guys, I saw his name, he was actually hung for treason. So there's things going on there that I don't know, but I want to find out more about, and that they've just got the feeling that there's more to that story.
Meanwhile, an army engineer who had taken part in the Siege of Louisbourg in 1758 has just completed his masterwork. The work was an extensive survey of the eastern seaboard of North America, known as the Atlantic Neptune. The man who undertook the monumental task was Joseph DeBar.
Anybody who's been in the Army or the Navy or anything that requires real knowledge of the land knows that there's very little you can do if you don't have good maps. And that was essential. And the maps were pretty darn good.
So there was a lot of knowledge there that was very unofficial, right? So, like, the fishermen come and they know where all the little harbors and things are, but everyone had little bits of knowledge that A, they didn't always share, and B, were restricted to a certain area. So the idea of having like a comprehensive project was, not that it was completely new, but for this area to combine all that knowledge and to actually sort of put it down, you know, like rather than being passed verbally amongst people who were working together. Yeah, that was sort of the important thing, because then you could sort of make plans, right? Again, strategic and long-term development.
DeBar didn't get paid for him at least as much as he wanted. So he was always kicking up a fuss to get his money back. So to shut him up, they did what people have done in the past. They gave him a nice title, made him Lieutenant Governor of Cape Breton, as his colony was then.
As the newly minted Lieutenant Governor of the colony of Cape Breton, it was DeBars who would lay out the streets of the colonial capital. The new town was named after the British Home Secretary of the time, Thomas Townsend, the first Viscount Sidney.
DeBar had scouted out the place and laid out the towns and made things ready to have a settlement here, because they wanted a settlement on this spot because of the importance of the site, right, as a sort of naval, strategic naval location.
While DeBar is making plans for the new colony he's been put in charge of, the Loyalists are making homes for themselves in Canada. In Quebec, Abraham Cuyler, the former mayor of Albany, New York, is recruiting fellow Loyalists to head east to the colony of Cape Breton. One of those adventurous souls is Jonathan Jones.
At that point, they decide as a family they're leaving the United States, and they come first to Quebec, settle in Quebec, and then he has a number of brothers,
and his mother is still alive, and they settle in Maitland, which is near Brockville, Ontario, which is sort of like the beginnings of a thriving community, a thriving city. And I was really curious, why did Jonathan Jones not go there to continue the kind of life he had lived in Glens Falls? You know, there would have already been a community there where he could have been a justice of the peace, he would have opened up a business, but instead he chose to come pretty much to an uninhabited, in terms of settlement, definitely the Mi'kmaq were here, but in terms of there being the kind of structure that Jonathan Jones was used to, that did not exist when he came here, because Lewisburg was in ruins. And that's where he lived for a number of years.
Kyler's group of loyalists land in Lewisburg just in time for winter. Over a cup of tea, I asked David what that first winter would have been like for them.
Oh, pretty awful, I imagine. They only had a couple of shelters made. I think the governor at the time, Halifax governor at the time, gave them a bunch of hinges to make doors with it. But already a Lewisburg fortress had been torn down by Foul Weather Jack Byron was his name. And he was called Foul Weather Jack because every time he went out on his ships, there was a storm. Masts were torn down, sailors lost overboard, so they gave him a desk job in London. And then the chance came up of a decision we finally, unlike the mistake we made in 1744 of letting the French back into Lewisburg, this time we'll tear it down. So Foul Weather Jack, as he was called, an admiral, came over to Cape Breton and he tore it down. So there was nothing much left there when the people from Kyler's group arrived. And similarly, the following spring, when Dubar arrived with his group of English immigrants.
As David said, there was another group of English settlers brought directly from England to the New World by Dubar. As Joyce explains, Dubar's group brought vital skills to the new colony.
So that's the sort of center of the fishing industry, like Plymouth and all those towns. Mm-hmm. That's where the transatlantic fishing trade was really centered. That's why if you hear people from the West Country, to me, they sound like Newfoundlanders. Like there's a lot, like that accent got sort of transferred to Newfoundland. Not all of Newfoundland, obviously there's variations in the accent, but yeah. There were tons of people from there who ended up, settling. So that basically that was the sort of epicenter of the transatlantic fishing trade, and boat building, and it was like a huge industry. That was the primary industry of that whole part of the country. I mean, obviously, it makes sense that those would be the people who would come to settle as well, right?
For Jonathan Jones, his time in Lewisburg was marked by tragedy.
One of his children is named Thomas, and he's listed as having lived with them in Lewisburg, and then he's not listed as having lived with them when they finally settle in Bedeck. And so I think actually Thomas drowned in Lewisburg, so I don't know that Lewisburg was a terribly happy place for them. Obviously suffered great tragedy there.
It is also while at Lewisburg that Jonathan Jones is the victim of a crime, which leads to the first sentence ever handed down by the Supreme Court of Cape Breton. The name of the thief is lost to history. His crime was the theft of 16 pairs of white yarn stockings, 8 check shirts, and 2 pair of cloth breeches, with a total value of 22 shillings. The goods were taken from Jonathan Jones's store. The unknown thief stood trial in February of 1786 and was found guilty. To avoid the death penalty, the man pled benefit of the clergy. He avoided the gallows and was instead sentenced to be burned on the hand and to 6 months' labor in His Majesty's coal mines. When the opportunity came to move inland to Sydney, the settlers, both loyalist and English, were more than happy to take it.
I would have imagined that they realized that Sydney offered a better all-round potential. Mm-hmm. And also, Dubar would was the new governor, so he would have had the authority to say what happened and where they should go. So I imagined he used his position. If he needed persuasion at all, they were probably only too glad to get out of Lewisburg and come to Sydney.
Upon arriving in Sydney, the harsh conditions and shortages of food and supplies led to frayed nerves. The governor's executive council devolved into petty squabbling and infighting.
My understanding, there was like competition. I mean, it was all very political, right? So a lot of the people who came from the U.S. were people who were used to being sort of politically influential, right? And so they all had their ideas about how they wanted things to run. And yeah, there was a lot of competition and infighting, and, you know, it was really unfortunate because, well, there's a lot of people who say that that was why, because the difficulty of governing this colony, that's why it was then absorbed into the colony of Nova Scotia, because of the difficulty of, you know, dealing with the factions and infighting.
I suppose, simply put, the English crowd and the American loyalist crowd were two separate divisions, and they had a lot of cantankerous episodes between them.
We forget how few people there were. And so anybody in that sort of social class would know the others. Like, everybody kind of knew each other, right? It was a pretty small town. So even though they came separately, they would have all known each other back home. And had, you know, and also because of their, you know, political affiliations, they would have been in contact. They would have, a lot of them, you know, worked together, known each other. So it wasn't like two groups that didn't know each other. But that also means that there would have been personality differences and like old grudges that got brought along with them. So that makes things easier in some ways and harder in others, I guess.
Hard feelings between those first residents of Sydney lasted for years and led to feuds between the prominent people of Sydney. As an example, much has been written about the acrimonious relationship between Attorney General David Matthews and the Reverend Rana Cossett. Cossett came to Sydney shortly after the founding of the town.
Well, he came, so he was hired to minister to the soldiers at the garrison, and then added to his responsibility was ministering to the loyal. So he came from New England with them at the same time.
I think it had been a bit of trade in timber between New Hampshire and Cape Breton. And there were probably commercial ties that he was very well aware of. He wasn't the chaplain. It was a man called Lovell, I think, was the chaplain for the military. But the senior chaplain in the area became Cossett. And eventually the church of the era revolved around Cossett. He went back a few times, both to visit his wife, who was stuck in New Hampshire, and I think to further timber deals as well, although I'm not sure of that. But there weren't. It was amazing how, despite the war, it's very similar to the War of 1812, despite the war, a lot of trading continued as if it was in peacetime.
Meanwhile, David Matthews, who was once the mayor of New York City, had more pressing reasons to come north. It starts with the attempted assassination of George Washington.
The story goes that Washington had his breakfast brought to him every morning, and he was given bacon, eggs for breakfast. The maid brought the dish in, and he had bacon, eggs, and peas. And he said, "What the hell are you giving me peas for?" and brushed them off his plate. And along came some chickens, ate the peas, and all died. They'd been poisoned. The rest of David Matthews was... they were all arrested and put on trial on... the jail at the time was on Wall Street. And as I joke, a lot of people think Wall Street should still be the jail there. They were sent to jail in in Connecticut, I think, New Haven, Connecticut. David Matthews gave his parole that he wouldn't escape, but he did. He was a nasty SOB. So he escaped, got back to New York, where he had a reputation of looting the coffers of the state for his own big family. He fled when the fleet sailed out, when the Loyalist fleet fled out, he went back and resumed his post as mayor of New York. But when the fleet carrying the refugees north to Nova Scotia left, he was with them, I think, but went to Halifax after Shelburne, went to Halifax, where he wanted to be the Attorney General of Halifax. Either that or the mayor, but Halifax probably knew of his reputation. So they sent him down to Cape Breton instead, and he became Attorney General down here.
Cossett and Matthews were both stubborn, hard-headed men, and they got on like oil and water.
Greatly unpopular. Cossett wouldn't bury him in the churchyard. I think he was a pretty nasty piece of work, even though he was a loyalist. There you go. David Matthews caused a lot of controversy here, particularly with Cossett, Rana Cossett. In fact, Rana Cossett was a bit of a firebrand himself, and the bishops said something to the effect that if Cossett stays here too much longer, the colony will be divided into Baptists, Presbyterians, Roman Catholics, and infidels.
Despite the acrimony, these early Cape Bretoners, both Loyalist and English, began settling into life on the island, building homes and farms, and expanding to settle in other parts of Cape Breton. David and Pam live on one of the original Loyalist farms, a piece of land given to a Mr. Jefferson in Point Edward.
Well, it was settled by Jefferson. I've always wondered if the Jefferson from Virginia was any relation to the Jefferson from Virginia, but I don't think the Jeffersons of American history would particularly wish Thomas to be mixed up with Loyalists, so they haven't researched that side of the family, and I don't know. But he got a land grant here of 100 acres. Subsequently, this part of this land was sold off much later in the 1950s. The back part of this land was sold off to what eventually became Devco land. But they were all junks of 100 acres here. If you were an officer or a professional man, you could get much more. Some got as little as 400 acres, but mostly they got 1,000 acres. But the farmers got 100 acres. But when you consider that they had to clear the land to farm, that was probably quite enough. This place, I mean, it must have been a hell of a job constructing this place, because they put huge stones, rocks in the basement to build the foundation, and then they had to do all the logs and all that. So it was a long job. And even in the few years, well, the 50 years we've been here, see the way the woods grow up so quickly if they're neglected.
Okay, so a lot of the times, said people were given land grants, right? So then if you're, whatever place you're in, people traded them and then sold them and bought others. You know what I mean? So there was a fair amount of travel. Like, people forget, you know, how much travel and sort of resettlement. I mean, so many of the families that, you know, same came in certain date, but then it's like, oh, first they lived here, and then they lived here, and then they end up living here. You know, people didn't always settle where they first arrived. And yeah, I guess I find that there's this assumption that, you know, everyone just came, stayed where they were, and, you know, lived happily ever after. But people moved around a lot.
Yeah, it was a place where the Loyalists could settle. And yeah, I don't think that they had put a whole lot of thought into it. And if you research his brother, Solomon Jones, who was a doctor, who settles in Maitland near Brockville, Ontario, he becomes like an MP in the... It's not the Canadian, it's the Upper Canada chamber or something like that. So he's a politician there. But if you research him, there's a, the house that he built is now a museum, and it was built like in 1802 or something like that. And so there's quite a bit. That's why we have these letters from Jonathan Jones, because he sent them to his brother, Solomon. And Solomon And one of Jonathan Jones's sons, I think, was involved in the War of 1812. So there is some involvement. Like, they do go back. Some of the descendants do go back to the places where Jonathan Jones and Solomon Jones lived in upstate New York and try to claim, try to take the land back. But they weren't successful. I think what happened is they couldn't. The governments there said, we don't have any records, so we don't know that you ever lived here.
Captain Jonathan Jones is given 1,000 acres on the shores of the Bredour Lakes.
Yep, 1,000 acres on the Bredour Lake with additional acreage in Sydney. He begins to clear a spot on the banks of the Bedeck River where he built a home, and within a decade had a thriving farm with almost 100 cattle, sheep, a small grist mill, and a sawmill. So, he had a successful farm there. And in some of the letters, he talks about the clover, how different it is from what he's used to growing. And he also talks about the grist mill that he has. And he says, you'd laugh to see how big it is. It's no bigger than a peddler's box. So obviously what he had in New York was, you know, more substantial than what he creates here in Bedeck, but it's enough for him to survive on, him and his family to survive on.
The family homestead attracts others to the area, and the village of Bedeck is born.
I've never been able to find the exact date, but I say circa 1790, because his family actually continues to live in Lewisburg, and he comes here and starts clearing the land and building a cottage, and that takes a couple of years. So it's at some point between 1785 and 1791, and I think some historian in the last 150 years picked 1791 as the moment we had a permanent settlement in Bedeck. It's along the Bedeck River, and that actually was Bedeck, and that's something in my research. For years, I always said that Bedeck is, I read it everywhere. Bedeck means place with island nearby, and everybody points to Kidston Island, but Bedeck was originally settled along the Bedeck River, which is not near Kidston Island. So it may refer to some island in the Bedeck River, but I don't think it refers to Kidston Island here. I've looked up in, there's some Mi'kmaq dictionaries I found, and Ibedeck means a sultry place, which life along the river, you know, in the summertime could be a very warm, a good place to grow crops. So that would be a place you would want to go to settle. And also in my research, in looking on websites in Saratoga, where Jonathan Jones fought, there's a national park there. And if you go to their website, the pictures of the Hudson River there looks exactly like the Big Bedeck River running through Big Bedeck. So you can understand why he chose there. The reason today it's called Big Bedeck is because that's where the community grew between 1791 and 1860. By 1860, a lot of settlement and people in Bedeck, the village that we now know as Bedeck, began to grow. And, of course, Big Bedeck became smaller. But this place where we are, Bedeck, was called Little Bedeck as compared to Big Bedeck. So Big Bedeck remains, but Bedeck is now just Bedeck. It's no longer Little Bedeck.
Meanwhile, the English began to realize the potential of the abundant coal fields surrounding Sydney Harbor and make the first moves to exploit them.
One of the princes, who's like the fourth son, right? Mm-hmm. So he doesn't inherit very much, but what he did inherit was the mineral rights. So that was part of his inheritance, and he wasn't that old, but he was sick and he was dying. So he sold the mineral rights, basically, the mining rights, to this sort of consortium. And so, yes, they immediately sort of set to work to develop it and exploit the resources that were there. So no, the French hadn't really done much to develop it. I mean, they knew that the resources were there, but nobody really did very much. And part of that is that would require a fair bit of investment, right? I guess because it was a sort of consortium that made it possible. I mean, no one person would really have that much resources to develop it.
The value of Cape Breton coal, coupled with the difficulties of governing a colony so divided, led to the annexation of Cape Breton to mainland Nova Scotia in 1820. I asked if the resentment over the annexation is still part of Cape Breton's makeup today, and got some surprising answers.
Yes, because that independence movement is not, like, it's only really this part of the island that where that's really strong. So there's that, and then there's the whole, you know, the industrial age and the relationship that created. So there's those two things, I think. But yes, I would say that had to do with it, because that resentment, you know, of being absorbed, it's hard to give up something you've had.
I think it's generally true that people who live on islands feel more independent than people who live on continents. So the English feel quite separate from the Europeans. New Yorkers, my wife, feels very much a New Yorker, not part of the rest. They're individual. There's a sense of being on your own on an island and seeking independence in that way. I haven't any facts to back that up. But, what the hell, facts? I've bothered too much. Yeah. Yeah, I think islanders feel more independent than that's probably the main motive. I mean, when. You know, what it was, the General Mining Association took over, came to Cape Breton in, I think, 1829, and all of a sudden, Cape Breton began to be one of the most prosperous parts of the area. And then, of course, the mines developed, and the steel plant came. It's only, to the best of my knowledge, with the decline of Cape Breton industry that this feeling of independence has sprung up.
Those early English settlers are all but lost nowadays. There is no United Empire Loyalist chapter on Cape Breton Island, for example. But they left their mark all the same. Some of the names of the settlers in DeBar's group still ring today, names like Rudderham, Mugga, and Bentick.
There's still a place out on the Bedeck River called the Bentick Farm. We still call it the Bentick Farm today, even though that guy never settled there. But that's where Bell and the AEA flew their planes in 1908. Because once the lake was no longer frozen, they had no flat place to fly. So it's interesting that Bell chooses that place, because it's a big meadow where they could fly the planes and it was flat. More history. Another layer of history.
A special thanks to Joyce Rankin, Sarah McGinnis, Jocelyn Bethune, and David and Pam Newton. Thanks for the cup of tea. On the next episode of The Story of Home, the Irish and Scottish make a home on Cape Breton Island.
Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.